Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And Devin, it took me a while to remember how to do that.
I know. Well, it's funny. I was just thinking about, so this is episode number 60.
Yeah, and we've done more than 60.
Oh, yeah.
Count all the bonus Patreon episodes, which are close to 30, I think. And then
yeah.
the quote-unquote mini-sodes that were actually just like full episodes that weren't actually so many.
Exactly.
I think we've done, we're inching toward, I think, 100 separate segments of content.
Yes, we are. It is
bananas.
It is bananas.
I mean, women get shit done. Does it surprise us? No. But the point is that it's been a while since I did the lead-in. I think it's been like 3 weeks. And I was like, Evan, what is our, like, podcast
what do we
slogan?
Say? Like, what do we do?
Where am I?
What is a podcast?
What is life? I don't know. Anyway, so Devin and I are long distance again. And when we say long distance, we mean LA traffic of distance. I'm definitely still feeling better. Not 100% still. Probably could have come over.
Yeah.
But we have a crossover podcast on Thursday, which we'll remind y'all about in our listener feedback and update section, but I was like, I want to make sure I'm up and ready to do that in person. So we figured we'd play it safe. And that's like the biggest lesson I think I've learned in my latest spell of headache landia is that I need to make sure I'm taking care of my body. And
yeah,
I think that's a good lesson for me to learn. And
it is.
So we're doing it long distance.
Right.
But it's still fun.
It's still fun. I'm still so happy to have Sarah back.
Aw, me too. I'm just so happy to be back because it is, you know, doing this podcast is a big part of like how I take care of myself during this sort of bananas time in politics, because it is such a big release and it feels good to talk about politics with a super smart lady friend.
Hey.
And a bunch of other smart friends are hellions.
Absolutely. It's amazing.
Devin, why don't you take us through what we're going to discuss today? And we're going to do things slightly differently because we basically have one big sort of in-depth section. Mega section.
I know. I called Sarah yesterday and I was like, it's going to break our format a little bit, but I've got a lot to say.
I like it. Let's go bananas.
So first off, we'll do listener feedback and general updates as always. So block two is sort of a mini block. There were two little stories.
It's sort of like a setup block, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more like a setup block. So it's basically a couple of like Trump land Russia stories that kind of leads us into block three, which is our main news block, which is about, you know, big data's role in the election and how the Russians got their hands on some of this data that you need to target ads. You know, we just found out that Facebook has sold $100,000 worth of ads to Russian-backed accounts. So sort of talking about all that and pulling
this happened
together
during the campaign. It didn't just happen during the campaign. Yeah, so there's been a lot of news stories swirling around Facebook. It's been a while since Devin and I did a Russia section, so we figured this was a good time to really dive deep into what's happening right now, especially as it relates to data, Facebook, the role of social media platforms, what's happening in the special counsel's investigation. So that's what we're going to do today, because it's our motherfucking podcast.
It's our motherfucking podcast. And then block four is the gratitude check. And now I've been reading Hillary's book and the chapter title Grit and Gratitude. I was like, that's so on brand for Hellbent.
I think she's one of us.
I'm telling myself
that she's one of us.
I know.
She gets it. Hillary, if you're listening, we'd love to talk to you on here. Just saying.
So then block five, it's Monday. So we do Dickwad of the Week and, it's a doozy.
Yeah, we have an honorable mention and a quote-unquote winner/actual loser.
Loser.
And I rallied hard for this one. You'll see why.
Yeah. And then finally, we have some action items, so something you could do after you listen to the show.
Okay, Devin, let's get into our listener feedback section, and then we also have a couple of updates. So what's our first bit of feedback?
Yeah, so first from May in our Facebook group, she said, quote, catching up on Thursday's podcast and just wanted to say thank you for the emphasis on correct pronunciations, especially of names. As someone who's been called my, me, and even Mia, it's pronounced May, having something as basic and fundamental as your name repeatedly gotten wrong is alienating alienating and a somewhat insidious, if often unintentional, reminder of being other, especially if you're already an immigrant. This is why I really, really try to get everyone's names right in pronunciation and spelling, even for people I don't particularly care for, e.g. Seth Rogen with an E, not Rogen with an A.
I love that she used Seth Rogen as her example. I was like, hard same. Hard and same. Also, I will say that is the biggest reason why, like, I think we take pronunciation so seriously is because of what May so beautifully stated and described. Yes. And it always makes my, like, stomach fall when we get a name wrong. Because I'm like, we try so hard because we know how important it is. But we always appreciate the corrections. Of course, we're always open to that. But we do take it very seriously. And we're glad to see that listeners like May appreciate that. So thank you for that bit of feedback, May.
Yes.
And then Shannon tweeted at the Hellbent account, but she was talking to me, "You're definitely not a lone wolf, Sarah, and great to hear you back on Hellbent." And so the first part she's referring to sort of my worry about Medicare for All, this rollout, this announcement happening just as Republicans are looking to repeal ACA again. And we're seeing that effort definitely ramp up. We're not going to be talking about it in the podcast today because there's not a whole lot of information. But we figured we'll probably talk about it on Thursday with the Pantsuit Politics girls, which we're doing a crossover with. But so thank you to Shannon. I'm glad I'm not like a lone wolf because I definitely am like looking around being like, what's happening? Am I feeling different? And I'm also very glad to be back on Hellbent. I'm glad that you're glad.
Yes. That actually is a nice segue into our update. So our crossover show with Pantsuit Politics is on Thursday. We're so excited to talk to Beth and Sarah. It's going to be amazing. And like Sarah said, we're going to probably be focusing on healthcare and the Graham Cassidy bill. We do have an action item relating to this at the end of the show. But like Sarah said, there's not a ton of new information from the weekend. So we're kind of waiting to see what's going on with that before we dive too deeply into it.
We just know that there's like an urgency, but we don't have a whole lot of more information. We figured more information will happen throughout the week, and Thursday will be a perfect opportunity to discuss everything we know.
Yes. And then finally, please listen and rate us on iTunes. And if I sound thirsty, it's because I am, and pumpkin spice lattes aren't cutting it these days.
Did you see how Martha Stewart said pumpkin spice is for basic bitches?
Yes.
She just was like, she just went in on pumpkin spice.
She's not wrong.
She's, you know what? The thing is, I don't even like pumpkin spice.
Okay, I don't like pumpkin spice latte. I like the gingerbread ones.
Yeah, I like, there's like a fucking, I don't even remember, like a praline or something, like hazelnut praline, and I'm like about that life. Okay, Devin, let's get into our, what we refer to as our setup block, which is Trump land bullshit, but slash, you know, some Russia related shenanigans, which will, like I said, like we said, set up for this bigger Russia block. So what's the first news item that we want people to get on their radars?
Right. So hold on tight, my friends, because I'm in a mood this morning.
Which is an evergreen tweet. We're evergreen always in a mood.
I am.
Amidst this administration.
So basically, let's start this day out horribly. The ethics watchdog of the White House, the Office of Governmental Ethics, decided that it's totally cool for lobbyists to donate money anonymously to the legal funds of people working in the White House.
Yes.
So let's back up a little bit and give a little bit of context to this. So in 1993, the OGE, the Office of Government Ethics, decided that anonymous donations from those normally prohibited from donating, like lobbyists and other business interests, to legal funds of White House staffers were fine. The theory was that because they were anonymous, there was no conflict of interest.
Wait, they decided this in 1993?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought, okay, I'm going to let you keep going because I was like, I thought this was what was in contention now.
It is. Because back in 93, the OGE was like, well, no, that's not a good idea. So they advised lawyers to avoid money from lobbyists, anonymously given or not. So, however, the OGE didn't officially change the guidance document on this issue. But they did sort of say, like, this is just guidance and we do not recommend this. So basically it was largely forgotten about during the Bush and Obama years because those White Houses didn't have any major legal battles, which would require the OGE to get involved.
Interesting.
So Walter Schaub, before he resigned, tried to pull in the guidance document for review. And so he added a note. He was trying to get it, like, basically killed, but he added a note that basically says, "This sucks, needs to be fixed." I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what he said.
And just a quick background, Walter Schaub used to be the head of the Office of Government Ethics, and then he resigned pretty recently, kind of in a dramatic fashion, being like, there's only so much I can fucking do. These people are fucking unethical. Again, paraphrasing.
We're paraphrasing, but you know.
We're paraphrasing.
So then the incoming head of the OGE, David Arpol, removed this note. And in a statement, the White House said, quote, "It is not helping to set up any legal defense fund, and it is also not pushing for any change that allows anonymous donations."
Wait a sec. I'm a little confused.
Yes.
In 1993, OGE said it's totally fine if you receive anonymous donations. Mm-hmm. That never got changed, but people pretty much didn't. That wasn't relevant because you're saying people, the administrations didn't have any big legal battles.
Right.
But so what is the White House saying now?
Right. So now the White House is saying anonymous donations are fine. They're basically saying this guidance document is correct.
Gotcha.
And we haven't changed policy. So I was also confused when I started looking into it. Okay. I thought it was a recent thing as well.
Me too. It turns out
it's not. It's just a very complicated sort of.
The interesting thing about when Walter Schaub left, he actually raised a flag and said the person who's next in line, who should be elevated to acting director, this person will probably get bypassed by the Trump administration because this person is going to be more along the lines of me, which is like trying to be fucking ethical.
Right.
And that's actually what ended up happening. Like, Walter Schaub put up a flare about it. Like, they're going to bypass this person. And they did. So now I believe the acting director is the person who was under this other person who was like more loosey goosey with the rules.
Right. Well, and so this is only really interesting. And the reason we even looked into it for this show is that, I mean, everybody and their fucking mother in this administration has a lawyer now. And, you know, those fees can add up quick. And, you know, while Trump and Kushner are independently wealthy, you know, a lot of these people are not. But good news.
Yeah, because, like, Pence even set up a PAC.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
people were like, this is really weird that a vice president is setting up a PAC this early.
Yeah.
In the first place. And B, like, then people were wondering if anonymous donations to perhaps his legal funds would be funneled through there.
Right.
I also saw something on Twitter that there's a White House staffer, I think, who basically had to empty out their children's college funds to be able to pay for legal fees.
Yeah, like, it adds up.
It does not pay to be like someone who is serving in this administration or affiliated with.
Yeah, well, especially because it's not just if you're under investigation, but if you need to be called in as a witness, if you're being deposed, you need a lawyer there. Mm-hmm. But so the good news here is that this guidance document from the OGE is not binding, and Mueller can see who's paying the bills or funding the legal defenses of the people he's investigating.
Interesting.
Yeah, so just because they allow
the public can't.
Right.
The public does, which is worrying.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely a weird kind of complicated issue. Again, like I said, when I looked into it, I had no idea that this was set up back in 93. So, you know, but it is sort of interesting to note that this is coming back up because, like I said, everyone and their lawyers have lawyers.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this story is under the radar, but it's important because it'll probably come back up multiple times throughout.
Exactly.
As the Russia investigation continues to heat up.
Exactly. So kind of our next setup block, and this one just warmed my cold.
Setup story.
Yeah, setup story.
Yeah.
This just warmed my cold feminist heart. So Ty Cobb and McGahn are, which I'll get into who they are in a second, they can't agree on how much to cooperate with this Russia inquiry from the Mueller team. So McGahn is the White House chief counsel, and he wants to cooperate with Mueller but is concerned about executive privilege and setting precedent that would sort of stick with the White House after Trump leaves. And then Ty Cobb, who was brought in to oversee the White House response, another lawyer, to this Russia inquiry, he's saying he just wants to give everything to them, like give them everything quickly and get this investigation over quickly.
I believe Ty Cobb is also the lawyer who sent Natasha Bertrand, who is a Business Insider reporter, an email at like 1:30 a.m. on a Saturday night or early Saturday morning, asking her if she was on drugs.
Oh, good.
Because she was asking a bunch of follow-up questions about the Russia story that he didn't
well,
like.
We know that that dickwads like to stay on brand. So
they love to stay on brand. If anything, they're like, gotta stay on brand, gotta be a dickwad.
And so what warms my cold feminist heart about this story is that sometimes our job is reporting on squabbles between grown men who work for a confessed sexual assaulter. And there seems to be this trouble in paradise these days. And we know this because Cobb was talking to a colleague over lunch and a New York Times reporter heard them. That's how we know this.
The most Trump thing ever. Like,
seriously.
It's what's interesting about this is that I guess that they were having a conversation about McGahn, right?
Right. Yes. So they were saying that there was a White House lawyer that Cobb was calling a McGahn spy. And he said that McGahn had, quote, a couple of documents locked in a safe, which just sounds like a horrible James Bond movie plot. and he also, you know, he mentioned a colleague that he blamed for some of the earlier leaks and who had tried to push Jared Kushner out. It's just a very, like, this very nefarious conversation that they were having so loudly in a public setting that a New York Times reporter overheard them.
Well, that's, like, the hilarious part about this, is they're, like, talking about, like, they're talking about their own paranoia, essentially, with what's yes. going on with the investigation. Meanwhile, they're doing it in a very public place, like, right. a table over from a goddamn New York Times reporter. Like, y'all are playing yourselves.
Yeah, seriously. And there's a little nugget from this story from a source within the White House that said, quote, the uncertainty has grown to the point that the White House officials privately express fear that colleagues may be wearing a wire to surreptitiously record conversations for Mr. Mueller.
Which is just, again, if anyone's wearing a wire, they don't need to, because they're these two dickwad lawyers
are going to recount the whole thing in,
and it wasn't
in a
even
restaurant.
In the restaurant. It was like on the patio, like that's, on the street.
Like, that's amazing.
Again, y'all are playing yourselves. Like, this is a you problem. And it's just like, it just reminds me of just how incompetent all these people are. Like,
oh, yeah.
we have like fucking email subject lines that it's like, that basically say Clinton dirt.
Yeah.
Like, Russia, Clinton dirt.
Come and get it.
Yeah. Like, I love it, especially later in the summer. Like, these people are all nimbus. Okay, Devin, now that we've done our little setup block with
yes.
what's going on with ethics rules around donating to legal funds, and the fact that there are two fucking, lawyers who are... who are just, like, shouting about things that are happening on the Russia investigation. What do we want to talk about now? Now that we've talked about those stories, what is the big story that we think should be on everyone's minds?
Right. Okay. So this is where I'm going to get a little nerdy here for a minute.
Do it.
So basically... what we have to do here is follow the data. You know, the old, like, political, like, axiom, like, follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's important. But right now we need to follow the data. So let's back up a little bit. As I mentioned at the top of the show, it has just come to light that Facebook sold about $100,000 worth of ads to Russian-linked accounts during the 2016 election, like, during the campaign. So, you know, basically they sold over $100,000 to approximately 500 bogus accounts that are linked to a so-called, quote, Russian troll farm. Mueller's team served a search warrant to Facebook for the data related to these ads, including account information and the content of the ads themselves. So it's really interesting because having a search warrant is a really powerful investigative tool. And having one really, it means they're looking for something specific, and it definitely telegraphs a deeper indication of what the Mueller team knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, I'd mentioned Natasha Bertrand
in
one of the previous stories we were talking about, but she comes up again here because I was watching a MSNBC segment with her in it, and she was saying that this Facebook inquiry indicates that Mueller's probe is transitioning into a criminal matter.
Right.
Because foreign money being pumped into American elections is illegal. So right. The question is, did these Russian troll farms get help from the Trump campaign? Again, that's sort of the million-dollar question. And if so, if they can find evidence of that, that could definitely be considered aiding and abetting a crime.
Yes, yes. I mean, it is definitely getting extremely interesting over at Mueller headquarters, that's for sure.
Yes.
And I also just wanted to, you know, sort of say something really quickly. A lot of people were upset that Facebook didn't come forward with this information earlier. And I will say, I'm not going to give Facebook too much credit because they definitely did a lot of denying. And I'm not saying that they're this like paragon of ethics. Yeah. But what I will say is that I agree with them for waiting for a search warrant to hand over this information. I think it's really important that these companies are at least, attempting to protect the privacy of their users.
Yeah, because I actually agree with you there, because it could be a slippery slope.
Like, yeah.
How much power does the government have to compel
right.
Private companies on their own accord to just hand over information? I do think it's good that Mueller got a search warrant. Again, that indicates something more serious is happening if they got a search warrant. But yeah, I mean, I definitely am not happy with Facebook.
Right.
They denied that there was any of these shenanigans going on for a long time, and they finally copped up to it and admitted it. And I, you know, as Rachel Maddow was saying about her interview with Hillary Clinton, she was actually really surprised at how I don't think aggressive is the right word, but how strongly Hillary spoke against Facebook.
Yeah,
she was like basically saying like Facebook has a lot to answer for.
Yeah,
and they like need to start talking basically. And, you know, I know that when Hillary also talked with, I believe it was Kara Swisher and someone else at that Recode conference,
mm-hmm.
and she was basically intimating that she thinks that the Trump campaign helped Russia target these ads. She's like, how would they know?
Right.
Which so we'll get into.
Yeah, this is kind of where that story is going. It's also worth noting that Twitter officials are being called to testify in front of Congress about Russian use of that social media platform. So it's definitely getting very interesting. And I think we're in sort of uncharted waters here with social media and, you know, how people get their news these days.
Well, and how it can be weaponized, and how these social media companies were either unwitting accomplices or just didn't care. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Lauren Duca referred to this in our interview a couple weeks ago or last week. And she was saying that like entire newsrooms have shifted how they create news because of social media.
Yeah. You hear about this a lot. I have a lot of friends who are in publishing, and there's so many fucking big publishers that are quote unquote pivoting to video. And they're doing it because a social network like Facebook is putting more of an emphasis on video. And like Lauren had said in her interview with Devin, they fudged those numbers.
Yeah.
And so
they did.
They're just, you know, apart from what's happening with Russia, Facebook and to a certain extent Twitter is really reshaping how newsrooms are disseminating news. And we're seeing a lot of sort of run-of-the-mill reporters lose their jobs because of these quote-unquote pivots to video.
Right. So, I mean, that is definitely something that, like I said, we're kind of in uncharted territory here. We're trying to figure this all out together.
Yes.
but that does sort of lead us into this million-dollar question that Sarah alluded to. What good are Facebook ads if they're not targeted properly?
Right.
So this is key to understanding social media's role with the Russian interference in the election. Social media is only as good as the audience you get your material to.
Right.
So you have to know who you want to see your ads or content, or it won't matter how much you spend. So these Facebook ads sent targeted memes, propaganda, and fake news to not just swing states, but swing districts, swing populations mm-hmm. in swing districts. Mm-hmm. That is a complicated set of data to collect, collate, and access for anyone, let alone a foreign power.
Right.
So how did Russia get its hands on such specific targeting data? And possibly more importantly, did they have help from American citizens?
Yeah, again, these are the big million-dollar questions that we're sort of starting to slowly unravel and we're starting to learn more about.
Right. And unfortunately, we don't really have answers for you. But these are just things that, you know, mm-hmm. these are definitely where this story is going. So, again, a little more context, and I'll go through this quickly. But big data, which is what this sort of information is called, is sort of a new player on the political scene.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in some of the postmortems after the election, a lot of people were criticizing Hillary Clinton's campaign for sort of quote-unquote over-reliance on data and, like, not enough, like, following your gut and, like, you know, good old politics, like, what you know about politics. And it's, like, the thing is, it's not just, you know, the Democratic campaigns that are using data. It's clearly the Republican ones, too.
Oh, yeah.
And, like Hillary Clinton says in her book, you can't – you need both. Like, you need to – data is important and – I think there was a lot of people who were saying, oh, all the polling, all the models got it wrong, but they didn't.
They
didn't. Like, if you look at Nate Silver and 538's model, they and Nate Silver said this on Twitter, like, Donald Trump has a chance to win this presidency.
Right.
And they ended up getting sort of like the popular vote.
Right. Correct. They got the split. They said that she would win the popular vote by like 2.5%, which was
about 2%.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's very interesting. And we actually are going to get into big data as it relates to the Trump campaign in just a second. So put a pin in that. So, but basically, I just want to give a little bit of context on how this kind of stuff works, because it's actually pretty, a lot of people don't understand it, you know, mm-hmm. unless you're sort of a big old nerd like me, or, you know, are interested in this kind of stuff. It might be a little, like, it's not been on your radar. So,
or it's a little hard to wrap your mind around.
Right.
Because it's so intangible. Like, you don't really see what's going on.
Right. So advertising is no longer just regional or painted in broad strokes such as age or gender targeting. You can now target ads at hyper-specific groups or subgroups of people. So, for example, if we wanted to run a Hellbent ad in Texas, we could literally get it in front of just female students enrolled at University of Texas Austin mm-hmm. via Facebook. Like, that's how specific you can get. And that is an extremely simple example. Mm-hmm. And it's also why you see Facebook ads for running clubs in your area if you've recently bought running shoes online.
Right.
So it's creepy and it's extremely useful. So big data, though, is expensive, particularly the extremely specific data sets that are necessary for hyper-targeted ad buys. There is an entire industry dedicated to collecting, organizing, simplifying, and cross-referencing data points on everything from buying habits to political affiliations.
Right.
So, again, this is where we start connecting the dots a little bit here. So, again, let's start with this question. Could Russia get this information without inside help? Maybe.
Yeah, right. I've seen certain experts be like, yeah, I mean, they could do X, Y, and Z, but
I mean,
my money would be on they got some help.
Right. So actually, Mike Carpenter, who was an Obama administration assistant defense secretary specializing in Russia and Eastern Europe, said, quote, could they, the Russian government, have hired a warehouse full of people in Moscow and had them read Nate Silver's blog every morning and determine what messages to post and to what demographics? Sure. Theoretically, that's possible, but that's not how they do this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's not how Moscow would approach a problem like this.
Yeah, I mean, they're, saying. I think, you know, I would definitely tend to feel that way. And an expert is saying this, so I'm going to concur with that expert.
Right, exactly. It's like, yes, they could do it, but it would be easier for them to just do it another way.
Yeah.
Get help, right. And so this is where we kind of connect it back to the Trump campaign.
Well,
and
just to go back to that a little bit, I mean, Russia is good, you know, Russian intelligence is good at recruiting assets. Like, that's
100%.
What they do. And like, I, again, in my sort of headache vampire, I call it vampire mode because I was in a dark room for like a long time. You know, I was listening to Malcolm Nance's book And he was saying Russians are very good at recruiting people who don't even know they're being recruited, who are like unwitting agents.
I was just actually reading something about the Don Jr. meeting. This is a little off topic, but basically an expert was basically saying like, that's classic Russian tradecraft.
Yeah.
Like that sort of meeting. It's not even about like the information. It was kind of seeing if they would take the meeting, if they were receptive to it.
Kind of a test.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just important to keep in mind.
So let's talk about Jared Kushner. Speaking of,
let's talk about
potential Russian assets.
Yes. So the Kush actually did an interview with Forbes magazine back in November 2016, right after Trump was elected.
Wasn't he like on the fucking cover?
He was on the fucking cover.
And like Ivanka tweeted something like, "I'm so proud." And it was
It was.
I bet you are. I bet you are.
So in this interview, he bragged about his involvement in the data collection and digital strategy side of the Trump campaign. So basically, Kushner came onto the campaign with no specific role. And he said in this interview, he's like, I had no intention of getting involved in this campaign, which is bullshit. That's bullshit. But basically,
no one believes anything you say.
Exactly. But basically, once he came onto the campaign, he brought on Cambridge Analytica, which is a data mining firm funded by Robert Mercer. Sarah, who's Robert Mercer?
Robert Mercer is a Republican mega donor.
Yes.
Who was a top Trump campaign donor and also a top patron of Breitbart News. So in our past podcast where we've talked about Steve Bannon, is he going to have more influence outside the White House because, you know, Breitbart is funded by the Mercers, that's where that name pops up. And again, I think you're going to hear Cambridge Analytica pop up a lot as well in these Russia conversations.
Yes. So K-Dog was really good at this, basically. And I don't know
allegedly.
If it was him. Allegedly. I don't know if it was him.
I don't think K-Dog is good at anything.
That's true. But basically what this interview was saying.
He oversaw this effort.
This operation.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically they said, you know, quote, ineffective ads were killed in minutes while successful ones were scaled. The campaign was sending more than 100,000 uniquely tweaked ads to targeted voters each day.
And again, the ads the Trump campaign were sending is different from what was happening on the Russian troll farms.
Right.
So we just to be clear, we're wondering, the question is, did these troll farms get help from the Trump campaign? But in the meanwhile, the Trump campaign was pretty focused on these digital ads.
They were very focused on their digital ads. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of experts on both sides of the aisle are like, that social media sort of strategy, you know, really helped Trump in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Like that sort of targeting really was effective.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot, a big chunk of Americans, their primary news source is Facebook. And we know just separately that fake news was a big fucking problem that Facebook, again, you know, arguably did not do enough to sort of temper.
Right. Right. And so, you know, it's hard. There's not a lot of like connection in these dots, right? We know that the Trump campaign was running these hyper targeted ads, and we know that the Russians were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everyone obviously denies any collusion. Mm-hmm. Kushner, Cambridge Analytica, you know, everyone denies working with each other. You know, in K-Dog's testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee in July, he said, quote, about his role in the campaign, I ultimately worked with the finance, scheduling, communications, speechwriting, polling, data, and digital teams, as well as becoming a point of contact for foreign government officials. And that list sort of reminds me of Kushner's job list in the White House, peace in the Middle East, Russia relations, like ending world hunger.
Jared is in charge of literally everything, but nothing. It's like you don't have any sort of skills or anything indicating in your resume that you are in any way qualified to do any of this shit.
Right. And, you know, this is a very interesting and scary combination of roles to play. By his own admission, he worked for the data and digital teams and as a point of contact for foreign governments.
Yes. Yes.
That seems like some cross-pollinating there.
Well, I mean, lest we forget, the Kush met with Russians several times during the campaign and right after Trump was elected. And he lied about it, like, multiple times on his official government documents. Which, again, is something that also happened with Flynn, right? Didn't Flynn right. have to amend a bunch of different forms that he yes. had turned in?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just like there is a lot of shadiness and there's a lot of questions swirling around Jared Kushner. I think Jared Kushner is fucked. I think
he's fucked. So
he's totally
hard.
Fucked.
Oh my God. I mean, and if I were into conspiracy theories, which I totally fucking am, I would be very suspicious of Kushner's breadth of roles in the Trump campaign and sort of the sort of connections that he made with Russian officials.
Mm-hmm. And what they were doing. Because again, I think we should flag this story. Remember that fucking story of him trying to set up a back channel?
Yes.
With Kislyak, but like he wanted to go to like the Russian embassy.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
that guy, Jared Kushner is a shady motherfucker.
Oh,
again,
yeah.
Again, I think he's fucked. I mean, we will see. Like, right. You know, Robert Mueller's probe does not guarantee that any prosecution will happen or that anyone right. will, you know, necessarily be charged with crimes. But again, I think Kushner's fucked.
Yeah, I also think because Kushner isn't Trump's, like, blood family, I think Trump, he'll be the first person Trump throws under the bus.
I don't know, though. He, like, is obsessed with Ivanka. So that could
true.
Play a part. I think that's, like, part of why he, like, seems to adore Jared Kushner so much. Is because
right.
he's married to Ivanka. And, like, Ivanka is his, like, favorite person.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yes. So, anyway, we wanted to do a sort of deep dive into this because we
yes.
think it's, again, Russia is important. Voters care about Russia. And if
right.
they don't, they fucking should.
Absolutely.
It's our podcast. We care about it. It's been a while since we did a Russia update of any sort. So we felt like this was important to talk about. So yeah, stay tuned. Okay, Devin, let's get into our gratitude check, which we always, always love and need.
Absolutely.
So what are you grateful for today?
Well, I have two really quick ones. And the
nice.
First one is that the California legislature passed a bill requiring the presidential candidates to release 5 years of tax returns to appear on the California ballot. It's a really great step towards transparency and sort of codifying some of these things that were tradition, like releasing your tax returns, into actual law. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I like this move because I think a couple of different candidates for 2020 might be shaking it in their boots about that.
Exactly. So hashtag local politics is sexy.
Yes.
And then the second one, and this is what I'm really grateful for. So there's this great website set up by ex-Hillary campaign staffers called Hillary for America Design. So it's the designers for the Hillary campaign. They put together this website highlighting the design work done for the campaign. They have sections about the social media graphics, the designer collaborations, and even the fonts they used. So the front page says, quote, "May it serve as content for critique, a resource for future campaigns, or just a peek behind the curtain. As Hillary says, keep doing all the good you can for all the people you can for as long as you can."
Ugh,
so I know. So, I mean, as a design geek, I loved seeing the font choices explained, you know, like which fonts they used and why, and like how they like brought in like moods and like how they talked about things. And because I'm a decent human being, I loved seeing how much love and work and care was put into every aspect of Hillary's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And just the sort of way they structured the campaign and the choices they made were all to drive a positive message.
Yes.
Like, overwhelmingly, their design elements were for positive things, were for getting her message across. They did have a section on, like, opposition, like, how they sort of did these like negative messages about Trump and everything. But for the most part, it was overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah.
I also cried because it's beautiful and we should have had her.
Yep.
So.
Agreed. Hard agree.
Hard agree. So, okay, Sarah, what are you grateful for?
So I'm grateful for one thing today, and it is in the vein of hashtag local politics is sexy, because I got
yes.
another California shout out because we're
all
two
right.
California girls. So I'm super grateful for, the California state legislature, because on Saturday, the California Senate passed Senate Bill 54, which is legislation that would protect undocumented immigrants from possible deportation And they would do that by prohibiting local law enforcement agencies, which include school police and security departments, from cooperating with federal immigration officials. This law would also forbid law enforcement from inquiring about a person's immigration status.
That's awesome. That is
awesome. I'm like,
that's great.
Fuck yeah, California. So FYI, according to this article in the Washington Post, there are an estimated 2.7 million undocumented immigrants in California. And sort of on a related note, there are about a quarter of all DACA recipients reside in California.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So this is really, really big.
Which kind of harkens back to also my gratitude check from last week, which is the president of the UC system, Janet Napolitano, suing over DACA. And yeah, a big part of that is because so many DACA recipients
are in the UC system.
The UC system, mm-hmm, that it really can make a big impact.
Yeah. So California, I feel like, is showing up on this issue. And yes, so the vote was along party lines, which I guess is to be expected in these hyper-partisan times.
Yep.
And California governor, so our governor, Jerry Brown, is expected to sign it into law. And just a fun fact, California is actually not the first state to pass a quote-unquote sanctuary state law. The Oregon legislature passed a similar bill in 1987. So shout out to Oregon. Yeah. Oregon is also a state that has been doing a lot of good recently, too.
Yeah,
And they have a really awesome female governor. So shout out to Oregon.
Yeah, they have a little bit of a complicated history, but they are definitely like showing the fuck up.
As a state, they've put in some really good laws, especially recently.
Yes.
And this vote is interesting because it came just a day after there was another legal blow to the Trump administration. Again, the courts are like, fuck you, motherfucker. Smacking them down because, you know, the Trump administration has been trying to crack down on sanctuary cities. And a federal judge on Friday blocked the DOJ from withholding grant funds from Chicago and other cities that refuse to cooperate with immigration authorities. So cities that are essentially sanctuary cities, you know, the Trump administration is trying to punish them for not cooperating with law enforcement. And the court said, no, you can't withhold federal.
They did.
You can't withhold grant funds. So
that's amazing.
That's what I'm grateful for. Yes. Devin, what is our listener gratitude check today?
Okay, so this one comes from our listener, Sadie, who messaged us on Facebook. She said, quote, Sarah and Devin, I'm urgently writing to share my gratitude check while still at an amazing event. I'm a pediatrician, and this weekend is the major annual conference for the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm spending Sunday afternoon at a panel full of fierce, inspiring women physicians who are truly changing the world. This is not a session on women in medicine. It is a session about communications and media and public health, and all five speakers are women who are following their passions and fighting for children and speaking out and refusing to be silenced.
Yes.
Three of the speakers are immigrants, four are women of color, and all are at the beginning or middle of their careers. I'm going to say a brief word about each of them that far oversimplifies their accomplishments and recommend every single one of them as a Twitter follow. But the bottom line is, I spent the afternoon getting energized, inspired, and a bit weepy in the presence of these women actively changing the world.
Aww.
People often think pediatricians are soft and cuddly. We are. But we will also aggressively stand up for what is right. And I actually am going to read this because these are amazing women. So, one, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's at Dr. Burke-Harris, is a pediatrician in San Francisco who is a leading researcher and advocate on childhood trauma and the effects of toxic stress. Two, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, at Mona Hannah A., the pediatrician who broke the story and has continued to be the public face of the Flint water crisis.
Wow.
Yeah. Three, Dr. Rhea Boyd, at Rhea Boyd, MD, a pediatrician who writes and speaks about racial and social justice and police violence. Four, Dr. Wendy Sue Swanson, at Seattle Mama Doc.
I love that.
I know. A Seattle pediatrician who writes about vaccines, parents, and evidence-based medicine, which is kind of a fuck you to anti-vaxxers. Mm-hmm. And number five, Dr. Nisheen Aminuddin, at NAMD for Kids, a Minnesota pediatrician who's a straight-up rock star and was instrumental in fighting misconceptions in the Somali community during the recent measles outbreak. Thanks for encouraging women everywhere to stand up, speak out, and fight.
Oh my gosh, I love that gratitude check.
And I just love everything about that.
It reminds me of the gratitude check we had recently from a listener named Anya. And she was talking about the panel she moderated for women in video games. And she was like, it wasn't about being a woman in video games, which is, you know, important, but it was about, you know, just the
state of video games.
The state of video games and the challenges we're facing. And it wasn't just about, you know, being a woman or being a woman of color in video games. Which it sounds like this panel was like about a topic that just happened to have five badass women.
I know.
Talk about, which is kind of a dream.
All right, Sarah. So let's get into our dickwad of the week.
Jazz hands.
So we have, like you said, one dishonorable mention and one loser. So who is our dishonorable mention?
And FYI, there are always too many contenders.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really hard to narrow down. But we were just going to have a dickwad of the week, but we actually were calling an audible and adding in a dishonorable mention. And our dishonorable mention is to whoever the fuck thought it was okay to bring out Sean Spicer during the Emmys and do like a cute bit, because that shit is not fucking cute. Like, he stood up and lied to us repeatedly and in the service of a wannabe authoritarian, like, fucking leader.
Yeah.
And like, I just want to say, normalizing authoritarians is not fucking cute. And
it's not.
There was like a picture of like James Corden like kissing Sean Spicer on the cheek, which just really reminded me of Jimmy Fallon.
The ruffling.
I'm like, men, white men are fucking canceled. Like,
seriously,
none of you like actually understand how fucking creepy this is.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just really frustrating because on top of it just being like not okay, it's also like Sean Spicer has no consequences for lying to the American public from the podium.
It is a really, really creepy window into how easy and seamless it is for the media to normalize these people who, again, were in service of a guy who's like a bigoted lying motherfucker.
Right.
And it just, it's in such stark contrast to these calls for Hillary Clinton to shut up and go away. It's like,
yes.
Steve Bannon gets a 60 Minutes feature. Sean Spicer gets a little cute cameo at the Emmys, but Hillary Clinton should shut the fuck up. Like, that says to me so much about it, what is wrong with the media landscape and what is wrong with sort of the conversations we're having about this administration. I mean, we're seeing, you know, people like Jemele Hill get reprimanded because she's accurately calling the president what he is, which is a white supremacist. And it's like wild to me.
Well, yeah. And also I didn't watch the Emmys. Like, I just don't. And so I remember seeing on Twitter, like, Sean Spicer at the Emmys. And I swear to God, I thought it was Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer.
No, that would have been funny.
I know. I thought they were making a joke.
Yeah. Like, cause that's the point of comedy, right?
Right.
Is to sort of
satire,
punch up. And like,
right.
Someone like Melissa McCarthy appearing as Sean Spicer, that's making fun.
Right.
Of all, you know, and we've talked to Carlos Maza before on the show about how, like, satire and comedy are often powerful tools against these things. But, like, bringing Sean Spicer out and, like, helping him rehab his image is fucking disturbing. So, that's our dishonorable mention. Devin, who is our loser? And I lobbied. I was like, because we used to call this award the Donald Trump Dishonor and Dickwadery. Because, like, we just assume Donald Trump is the loser every week. I mean, that's just an assumption. But this week, he is officially the dickwad of the week.
Yes, he is King Dickwad.
Yes.
And he this week is dickwad of the week. So Donald fucking Trump. There's a lot of reasons, obviously. Like we said, he's just sort of the de facto dickwad of the week.
But I
mean, this week in particular, he retweeted this like meme/gif made by an account called CNN Sucks. And Sarah asked me, is that really the name of the account? And I said, yes, it is really the name of the account.
Oh my God.
It's a clip of Trump hitting a golf ball, like out on the golf field. I don't know what it's called.
The golf course.
Thank you.
I'm the sports end of this partnership.
And then it cuts to Hillary Clinton falling forward onto an airplane with a golf ball photoshopped to look like it had hit her in the back and caused her to fall.
Ugh, fucking A, dude.
Okay, so this fucking on its face, Yeah, I mean, this on its face is disgusting. It's a reminder that no matter what people want to think, no matter what he says or does or promises or yells into the ethers, Trump is at his very core a violent, misogynistic little man.
Yeah, I'm like, remember like just like a few weeks ago or a month ago when he read off a teleprompter successfully and like
yeah.
reporters being like, this is a new Trump. I'm like, there is never going to be a new Trump, ever. Like, okay, all the evidence points to the contrary.
Okay, not shitting your pants on TV
does
not make you presidential. I'm sorry.
Nope, doesn't count. No. And it's like, it's wild. I mean, this is the same fucking person slash so-called president, really occupant of the White House, as we like to say, which is what Stacey Abrams so brilliantly deemed him on our show. You know, it's the same person who bragged openly about sexually assaulting women on tape. And he was still elected president, again, with the support of 53% of white women. So it's not new, but it for me, it doesn't make it any less disturbing. Like, I don't want us to get to a point as a country where Donald Trump is, like, retweeting shit from, like, Nazi-linked accounts or retweeting shit from, you know, an account that's called CNN Sucks that shows making fun of being violent toward women. I don't want us to get to a point where we all just collectively shrug. Right. I would also just like to remind folks that he, quote unquote, joked about someone assassinating Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. And people, for the most part, pretty much shrugged about that because that is how fucking normalized violence against women is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he literally called for, you know, someone in the gun lobby to shoot her. Like, you've got to be fucking kidding me.
Second Amendment people. Someone in the gun lobby.
Just, you're right. Like, just Second Amendment people. Person. You're right. Good call. You're right.
And I would also like to point out, too, you know, and Hillary Clinton mentions this in her book and in subsequent, or at least in subsequent interviews about her book, like, there was merchandise that was sold at Trump rallies that was very violent toward Hillary Clinton, that, like, showed her head, like, and Trump holding it. No one fucking blinked an eye.
No.
And we talked about Kathy Griffin on one of our Patreon bonus podcasts.
Right.
How we didn't agree with what Kathy Griffin did, but it seemed like there was more reaction to her doing something like that than, say, people on Trump's side. Because, again, violence against women is normalized.
Right. Well, and it's funny because I think in Hillary Clinton's book or maybe an interview, she says, like, all this really violent sort of stuff being sold and grandmas were buying it.
Yeah.
Like, that's how, like, normalized we've gotten.
53% of white women supported him. I mean,
exactly.
This runs
so
deep.
I would also this sort of brings us back just on top of everything else, like shit cherry on the shit icing on the shit cake, is the unique nature of Donald Trump maintaining a personal Twitter account.
Yeah.
So he uses it to create quasi policy, like the trans military ban,
which is going to be policy.
Right, which is now going to be policy.
But when he announced it, it wasn't well.
It wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And
well,
so
it was. It was, but he didn't think it out. He just announced it. Yeah.
You're right. And then insult nations with nuclear weapons like North Korea and retweet disgusting memes degrading those around him. I mean, this isn't even the first time he's done this. Like that clip of Donald Trump at the WWF event tackling a guy with the CNN logo over his face.
Yeah.
Like he's openly weaponizing his Twitter timeline against people, the free press, and now a private citizen specifically and horrifyingly, which is totally a word.
Yeah. Well, and he's just done it, like you said, multiple times. And he's, like, retweeted anti-Semitic accounts. Like, he's retweeted troll accounts. Like, this is a person that is apparently qualified to be president. And, like, this is how you know white male privilege is a fucking thing.
Right.
Because he's doing all this shit. He's embracing racists. He's under goddamn investigation for possibly and... for my money, probably colluding with a foreign nation, an adversary, and Congress is still letting him be president.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's...
So, anyway, that's our dickwad of the week. Again, most weeks we assume he's the sort of top dickwad, but I felt like it was important. We felt like it was important to shout this out because...
Well, he really earned it this week.
Well, and especially on the heels of Sean Spicer being rolled out in this sort of like kitschy manner and on the Emmys, like I think it's a reminder that these things are not normal. And like we should talk about how they are. Okay, Devin, so let's get into some action items. And we've got a few today. The first one is around healthcare. And like we said, we're probably going to delve into this issue more deeply on Thursday with the pantsuit politics ladies. But so what's our action item around healthcare?
All right. Well, so as we mentioned, the Cassidy-Graham bill trying to repeal Obamacare is reportedly going to be sent to the floor if McConnell can get 50 votes. And when I've last checked, they currently have either 48 or 49, depending on where you're getting your news.
And like, and previously too, I remember there were reports saying like McConnell's like, I'm not going to be involved unless like you whip up the votes. I won't be involved right. unless you can get it. But now it's looking like it's very possible.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, according to a poll by Harvard and Politico, repealing the ACA is still the number one priority for GOP voters.
That is so Yay! Weird to me because Obamacare is more popular than it's ever been, even among Republicans. So that seems very strange to me.
It's weird. I mean, what they did is they called about 1,000 U.S. adults and asked them to like review and score these questions. But basically what this poll found was, everyone hates ACA, at least if you're a GOP voter.
That's wild to me.
Yeah, yeah. So just a reminder, the deadline to pass a reconciliation bill to repeal Obamacare, which is what they need to do a simple majority,
right.
Is September 30th. So these dickwads are scrambling, and it is dangerously close to working. So we need to call our senators every day, every hour, until this bill is defeated.
Yeah, and again, this is sort of was one of our biggest worries. We talked about in the latest podcast, why would Bernie Sanders fucking unveil this Medicare right. for All shenanigans before September 30th? Why not wait till after? That is my biggest, right. that's my biggest question for Bernard. But yeah, this is definitely priority number one. Like, don't sleep on this repeal effort because again, Republicans like operating in the shadows and we have to put in as much public pressure as possible.
Right. And then on that note, we just want to remind everyone that the ACA open enrollment begins November 1st and runs through December 15th.
Right.
So Trump is doing his damnedest to cut this like Obamacare outreach. And so spread the word. November 1st to December 15th is not a ton of time. So make sure everyone you know knows and can get on this ASAP.
Yeah. If you want to sign up for Obamacare, that's the enrollment period. So that's definitely a good flag, Devin. And then finally, H.R. 620, which is the ADA Education and Reform Act, is a literal piece of fucking garbage.
Yes.
And it is currently in the House and just got voted out of the House Judiciary Committee, I believe.
Yes.
So the ACLU wrote an opposition letter to this and they said, quote, H.R. 620 would create significant obstacles for people with disabilities to enforce their rights under Title III of the Americans with Disability Act to access public accommodations and would impede their ability to engage in daily activities and participate in the mainstream of society. Rather, the burden of protecting the right to access a public space is shifted to the person with the disability who first has to be denied access, then must determine that violations of the law have occurred, then must provide the business with specific notice of which provisions of the law were violated and when. And finally, the aggrieved person with a disability must afford the business a lengthy period to correct the problem. So basically what they're saying is this shifts the burden on to the disability community instead
right.
of the burden being on the people who are supposed to be complying with this law. And
right.
again, it is a literal load of fucking garbage.
Yeah. So I'm just going to paraphrase. I'm going to paraphrase that whole ACLU letter really fast. Fuck this bill.
Yeah. Fuck this motherfucking bill. Please call your reps while you're talking to them about healthcare. Make sure
yes.
you talk to them about, you know, right now it's in the House. So your congresspeople, talk to them about H.R. 620 and tell them that you oppose this bill and you want them to forcefully do so as well.
Yes. All right, Sarah, I just can't get over how happy I am to have you back.
I am so happy to be back, and I'm really, really, really fucking excited to talk to the Pantsuit Politics ladies
yes.
because they're really fucking smart,
yes.
really fucking nuanced. I would encourage some Hellions who haven't listened to their podcast to do so before Thursday. So we're going to be talking probably about healthcare, but you know,
yeah.
just the topics du jour. It's going to be really fun to talk to other smart women about everything that's going on in this current political landscape. So we're really, really excited about that. And we can't wait to have Sarah and Beth on our show.
Yes, absolutely. So we will see you back here on Thursday. And thank you for listening. For more information on today's episode,
please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent.